When you've listened to a lot of sermons, you've heard a lot of preacher jokes, haven't you? And it's amazing how many of those end up having to do with how long the sermon is going to be. And, oh, it's funny, that guy, he's going to preach too long, and, oh, we can all laugh about that. Everybody kind of breathes a sigh of relief. I don't have a preacher joke this morning along those lines, unfortunately. Usually I measure my lessons and try to get within a certain time bracket based upon how long the notes are. And 3 pages of notes usually kind of does the trick to stay within the proper boundaries of time. Unfortunately, I'm well over it, and I'm worried about that. If this goes too long, I will humbly split this into 2 pieces and finish it at the end of the month. We'll see how it goes. I was inspired by Randy's lesson on the Pharisees last Sunday, and I really enjoy lessons that send me down a rabbit hole. Those are my favorite lessons. Everybody has a different reason they like a given lesson. For me, I really love it when I get in there and then I see something else and I hop to another thing and this sounds bad. By that time, I'm not listening probably like I should. And then I'm down this great rabbit hole, and that then bends my study for the entire upcoming week. And it really is helpful to me because I've got to have something to preach on. If I preach from a rabbit hole, then that the positive side of that is that it's pretty easy for me to put something together. The downside is these 6 pages of notes. So hopefully we will go through this fairly good. And I hope also that I do not repeat too much. We're going to be talking about the Pharisees today again, but we're going to talk about them from another angle, okay? So I want to come at them from a completely different side. We're going to go all the way back into the Old Testament where there were no Pharisees. And we're going to start there. And specifically, I want to start in Deuteronomy 3. We're going to begin our journey in the Old Testament as Moses is about to die, and he's going to hand off the leadership to Joshua. We find his farewell is recorded in the book of Deuteronomy. If we go to Deuteronomy 3, 23 through 29, Moses says there, "And I pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, you have only begun to show your servant your greatness and your mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do such works and mighty acts as yours? Please let me go over and see the good land beyond the Jordan, that good hill country and Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me because of you, and he would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, Enough from you. Do not speak to me of this matter again. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift up your eyes westward and northward and southward and eastward. And look at it with your eyes, for you shall not go over this Jordan. But charge Joshua and encourage and strengthen him, for he shall go over at the head of his people. And he shall put them in possession of the land that you shall see. So we remained in the valley opposite Beth Peor. Now after this little smacking of Israel for vexing him so much that he, of course, did not speak to the rock but struck it, right? That doesn't come up there, but he essentially says, you people are the reason why this happened to me. And Moses then glorifies the law, so continuing on in chapter 4. And now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the rules that I am teaching you, and do them, that you may live and go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. You shall not add to the word that I command you, nor take from it, that you may keep the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you. Your eyes have seen what the Lord did at Baal Peor, for the Lord your God destroyed from among you all the men who followed the Baal of Peor. But you, who held fast to the Lord your God, are all alive today. See, I have taught you statutes and rules as the Lord my God commanded me that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today. And the law is key to the identity of Israel. As they wander in the desert, as they make a tent temple to take with them, the law becomes their identity. The law becomes, and God tells them over and over again, keep this law, and these good things will happen to you. Deuteronomy, of course, as a book, is incredibly focused on the law. Deuteronomy itself means copy of the law. In fact, in the Septuagint, in Deuteronomy 17, verse 18, it says, in this passage here, it says, and when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law. That little phrase right there, a copy of this law, is Deuteronomion in the Septuagint. So the copy of the law, okay, is where that kind of comes from. And that's where we take to nomi, that Greek word for law, nomos, okay, gets taken out there. And so the book of Deuteronomy, as well as much of the first five books of the Bible, is really consumed with the law, isn't it? We saw the law, the Ten Commandments, given in Exodus, given also we see them in Deuteronomy, and then a big chunk of the remaining part of those five books is taken up with both expansions upon those commandments as well as case law established during Moses' journey with the people of Israel on the way to the promised land. Now, there are great promises given to Israel for keeping this law, and there's great curses for breaking it. Look at the blessings Israel was promised. If only they could keep this law, Deuteronomy 28. And if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, I'm starting in verse 1, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you if you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of your womb, and the fruit of your ground, and the fruit of your cattle, the increase of your herds, and the young of your flock. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before you. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. The Lord will command the blessing on you in your barns and in all that you undertake, and he will bless you in the land the Lord your God is giving you. The Lord will establish you as a people holy to himself, as he has sworn to you, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. And all the people of the earth shall see that you were called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. Notice here how the following of their commands, the following of the law, will result in people looking at them and being afraid of them. It will result in the expansion of their nation, will result in their success both personally, when it says you will be blessed in your fields, you will be blessed in your herds, but also nationally. They will be blessed as a nation. If they go to war against another people and they're following their God's commandments and God's laws, then it says, you know, they'll come against them one direction and flee in seven. And so we find here that Israel is told, follow these laws and things will go well for you. The Lord will make you abound in prosperity, in the fruit of your womb, and in the fruit of your livestock, and in the fruit of your ground, within the land the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. The Lord will open to you his good treasury, the heavens, to give the rain to your land in its season, and to bless all the work of your hands. And you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And the Lord will make you the head and not the tail, and you shall only go up and not down. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, being careful to do them, and if you do not turn aside from any of the words that I command you today to the right hand or to the left, to go after other gods, to serve them. Now, right following this are the curses for not keeping the passage. I'm not going to read that whole piece. Here's just a sampling of those curses. Let's see the flavor here. Deuteronomy 28, 15 through 25. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today. Notice here, once again, how constantly and consistently the worship of God is tied back to following his commandments. It's not merely that they would sacrifice. It's not merely that they would burn incense. A lot of ancient nations were like that. they would measure their piety by how active they were in their temples. And then outside of that, you could do whatever you wanted to do. It's funny because I said ancient nations are that way, but we have religions that are like that even now today. That's kind of a little bit of a Catholic thing, to be very pious within the temple, and then that means you can kind of do what you want outside the temple, outside the church, as long as you've said the proper benedictions, the proper number of Hail Marys, perhaps, as long as you've done the confessional, as long as you've done these things, then this other side of you can be as sinful as you choose. And that's a very human idea. In the ancient religions, it was very much that way. As long as you kind of paid your dues at the temple and did your sacrifices, you were good with that god. Okay, so if you were good with Marduk, or you're good with Baal, then you did your thing with Baal, and then you could go have your free time outside of that. But God ties his own worship back to obedience to him. In fact, when people aren't obedient, what is the phrase that happens if they are, if they behave like those other nations, and they're very pious in the temple, but not in obedience? He says, God desires mercy rather than sacrifice. And so when obedience comes head to head against temple worship and ceremonies, obedience triumphs. And we see that's kind of a constant in the Old Law and in the Old Testament over and over again. That doesn't come with the New Testament. That's a concept that we find in the Old. If you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today, all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, and cursed shall you be in the field. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your womb and the fruit of your ground, the increase of your herds and the young of your flock. Cursed shall you be when you come in, and cursed shall you be when you go out. The Lord will send on you curses, confusion, and frustration in all that you undertake to do, until you are destroyed and perish quickly on account of the evil of your deeds, because you have forsaken me. The Lord will make the pestilence stick to you until he has consumed you off the land that you are entering to take possession of it. The Lord will strike you with wasting disease and with fever, inflammation, and fiery heat, and with drought and with blight and with mildew. They shall pursue you until you perish, and the heavens over your head shall be bronze, and the earth under you shall be iron. The Lord will make the rain of your land powder. From heaven dust will come down on you until you are destroyed. The Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. You shall go out one way against them, and you shall flee seven ways before them, and you shall be a horror to all the kingdoms of the earth. Now, this idea of blessed if you do the law, cursed if you do not, and not just individually, we as Christians, of course, we might see ourselves corporately as the church, but in Christianity, we tend to look at our own salvation, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For Israel, there was a corporate idea of the nation's identity as they obeyed the law, or didn't obey the law, and were cursed because of it. Now that basic breakdown shows up as this bright thread all the way through the Bible. It's the core of the Old Testament. Keep the law, receive blessings, be obedient to God, and do well. Disobey and receive curses, both individually and as a nation. And indeed, much of the rest of the Old Testament is in fact a combination of the story of the fortunes of Israel and how they rise or fall relative to their own obedience, as well as the words of the prophets sent to warn them of the consequences of their disobedience. So obedience and disobedience become this big, big deal in the Old Testament. The story gets summed up in the first part of the book of Judges, Judges 2. 16 through 22. Judges 2, 16 through 22. I like this passage because this passage is almost like a preface to the book of Judges. The book of Judges is going to tell this story over and over and over and over and over, so much so that it's embarrassing. And it spans, you know, a few hundred years. And as Judges happens, though, we have this preface that essentially gives the story away before we even start the book. Judges 2, 16 through 22. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord. There it is again. And they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he saved them from the hands of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he said, "Because this people have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers and have not obeyed my voice, I will no longer drive out before them any of the nations that Joshua left when he died in order to test Israel by them, whether they will take care to walk in the way of the Lord as their fathers did or not." Now, as they come into the promised land, this testing, if you will, this consistent idea of do what is right and be rewarded, do what is wrong and be cursed, follow the commandments of God and receive goodness and blessing, do not follow them and be cursed and have everything you touch turn to dust, starts very quickly as they go in to the promised land. But the book of Joshua is this optimistic, upbeat book, kind of, right? I mean, good stuff is happening for them. But there's a few things that get left to test them. And as Joshua dies, he has that famous farewell speech that we all know so very well, where he says to the people of Israel, "Choose you this day whom you will serve." Now, is he talking about just whom you will make sacrifices to in your tabernacle? No, he means who you will obey, whose commandments you will obey. And they say to him, "Oh, we're going to do it." And over again, we see that. It's a little bit like how we are with task lists, right? And I'm going to do good today. I'm going to start today, and today's going to be a day that I exercise or that I read stuff. I don't spend too much time on the TV. And then it just falls all to pot. We're kind of like the Israelites that way. But over and over again, they do that, right? They make promises, and they seem to be on the upswing. And then a generation comes or goes, and the next one doesn't know God, it says. And by doesn't know God, it doesn't mean doesn't go in the tabernacle. It means doesn't obey his commandments. And so over and over again, we see that same idea. And right there in Judges doesn't say that they started sacrificing elsewhere. They were doing some of that as well in the high places, and they would go sacrifice. Polytheistic societies would sacrifice all over the place. And as Israel became polytheistic, it wouldn't necessarily displace God, but it would try to add stuff to God. And so a lot of Israelites, if they were ancient Israelites, if they were here, would have looked at us strange and said, "I don't think you understand at all. I can have this Baal thing over here, but I go over here and I'm a pretty good," they wouldn't say Christian, obviously, but they'd say, "I'm a pretty good Israelite, and I go maybe three times a week, or I go do my sacrifices. I go over here to the tabernacle and do my thing." But that wasn't what God wanted. God wanted obedience, and he wanted them to understand that he was the only God, right? First three of the Ten Commandments. And he wanted them to understand that he was the only one worthy of worship. And so they would give up the commandments. And so we see this cyclic thing happen in Judges over and over again. We see them get handed over. Bad things start to happen to them. They turn to God. "Please save us." He saves them. He gives them a judge. And then while the judge is alive, just as that passage said, they seem to be obedient. And then they just fall all to pieces afterwards. And by fall all to pieces, I mean they stop obeying God. And so that cycle is written up verbatim. It's not just something that shows up in the narrative history. It's actually stated verbatim. So that right up there is the whole story of Judges. If you just read that little piece, you would know that's like a summary section in your Bible, okay? Except that it's in the text. And it says this is what Judges is all about. Is they try to do this only when there's a judge. God takes care of them. God hands them over to their enemies. Then they fall apart. Then they look to him. Then they, you know, so this cycle that comes and goes. Now, eventually, of course, they ask for a king, right? And when they ask for one, and the kingdom's divided eventually into two, and the northern tribes are then destroyed by the Assyrian Empire, and they essentially become just wiped out. There's nobody that can call themselves a northern tribe of Israel. Completely apart from what any modern religion might imagine that would be the case. There's nobody alive that can say, "I'm a member of the tribe of Issachar." and I can trace my lineage back to that. And so the northern 10 tribes, they go away. And by the time of Christ, that's true. Nobody says, I'm Simeon, or I'm Issachar, I'm these other tribes. By that time, there's only just a few left because the Assyrians have annihilated the 10 northern tribes. Now, if we go to 2 Chronicles 36, 11 through 16, we find out that, well, before this passage, of course, what has happened is that the remaining tribes, the southern tribes, have been taken captive by Babylon. And the writer of Chronicles wants to say why this has happened. And this passage will be somewhat similar, right, to the one we just read. 2 Chronicles 36, 11 through 16. Now Zedekiah was 21 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord his God. He did not humble himself before Jeremiah the prophet, who spoke from the mouth of the Lord. He also rebelled against King Nebuchadnezzar, who had made him swear by God. He stiffened his neck and hardened his heart against turning to the Lord, the God of Israel. All the officers of the priests and the people likewise were exceedingly unfaithful, following all the abominations of the nations, and they polluted the house of the Lord that he had made holy in Jerusalem. The Lord, the God of their fathers, sent persistently to them by his messengers because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place, but they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words and scoffing at his prophets until the wrath of the Lord rose against his people until there was no remedy. Now that in part, there was no remedy. Remedy for what? What that means is God was done with the cycle. There wasn't going to be a judge. There wasn't going to be help, at least not in the same way that they expected it over and over again. But the Old Testament story doesn't end there, does it? Now, if it had ended there, we might have said, well, look at that. They got annihilated just like the northern 10 tribes, and that's it for them. And where did they end up after that? Nobody knows. And we wouldn't have had really necessarily a New Testament. So it's a good thing the Babylonians weren't like the Assyrians. God, that was, of course, the will of God. The Babylonians pulled out and they allowed them to stay as a people. Okay, they may have transplanted them into Babylon, but they allowed them to stay as a people. Assyrians weren't like that. Assyrians would basically swap people out of the place, force intermarriage, and so they'd water down the people of the place. But the Babylonians allowed the Jews to keep some identity. And during the exile, that 70 years, while they were in Babylon, okay, and it's so important, the 7 years, that much of the Bible becomes split into pre-exile books and post-exile books. There's pre-exile prophets like Isaiah, and there's post-exile prophets Haggai, who says, hey, could you rebuild this temple over here? And that was a rebuild of what? Well, it was post-exile. They were coming back. You have post-exile history in Nehemiah and in Ezra, guys that are allowed to return to the land of Israel. And Chronicles is itself, at least partially, written post-exile, because right there at the end, in 2 Chronicles 36, if we hop down a few verses to verse 20, it says here, he took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him. Let him go up. And that brings us to the book of Ezra, which is absolutely pivotal. Now, why is this so important? So imagine you're a Jew and you live across the exile. Let's say like Daniel, who lived before the exile and after the exile, right? So let's say you live across that time. It's profound. You had the temple. You traced your lineage back to the time of the tabernacle. You watch those 10 tribes above you who had created their own goat gods, as Jeroboam, son of Nebat, did in a couple of places, because he didn't want the Israelites, you know, the northern tribes, he was king of the north, he didn't want them going down to the south. So he said, I can't have them going on, you know, worship back at the temple. I can't have them doing that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to build my own place for them to worship, and I'm going to set gods up for them. And they're remarkably similar to that, to the bull god, right, up in that Aaron makes, right? And he sets him up and says, look at this. This is your God, Israel. And God tries to talk to him, guys, to talk to them. And then the northern 10 tribes go on, and it's an identity. As a Jew, you would look at them and say, what? Well, sure, they got taken out. Those guys aren't worshiping God right at all. But we are still doing okay. And so you define yourself that way, and then all of a sudden along comes Babylon. And they come multiple times, and piece by piece they kind of pick you apart until there's not much left, and you've got people, read the Book of Lamentations, how silent still sits the city once so full of people, as a sort of post-apocalyptic book, which is really what it is, right? It's a post-apocalypse. The city of Jerusalem is completely annihilated. Solomon's beautiful temple, one of the seven wonders of the world, is just destroyed, laid waste, nothing left of it, a ruin. Now imagine that ties into your identity, who you are as a Jew. And so 70 years pass, but God has not forgotten you. God has not forgotten you. And so you're allowed to come back to the land, not as a people with a king any longer, mind you, not as a people or a nation, if you will, but now as a vassal state of Persia, okay, as a governing area, like another state of Persia, if you will. And you're allowed to come back. Now, what do you do? And the books of Ezra and Nehemiah are absolutely key here. And Ezra speaks to us of the reestablishment of the law, the reestablishment of the ceremonial, as well as obedience to the commandments. And that is like the key part of Ezra. In Ezra 9, 1 through 2, we find this. After these things had been done, the officials approached me and said, the people of Israel and the priests and the Levites have not separated themselves from the peoples of the lands with their abominations, from the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the Ammonites, the Moabites, the Egyptians, and the Amorites. For they have taken some of their daughters to be wives for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy race has mixed itself with the peoples of the lands. And in this faithlessness, the hand of the officials and chief men has been foremost. Well, why is that a problem? Why is that a big issue? Intermarriage, this kind of sounds kind of racist, doesn't it? I mean, to a modern hearer, we might say something like that. But recall that in Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 5, we had found this. And realize the similarities of this passage are on purpose, okay? Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 5. And now, our God, what shall we say after this? Oh, I'm sorry. I that's me trying to skip ahead in my notes. Look, I want you to tell you I'm three pages through already, which is good. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it, and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations more numerous and mightier than you, and when the Lord your God gives them over to you, and you defeat them, you must devote them to complete destruction. You shall make no covenant with them, and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons, or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But thus shall you deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and chop down their asherim and burn their carved images with fire. And so the return ends up being like on a much larger scale, because this thing was an apocalypse that happened to them. On a much larger scale, the return is like getting a new judge. Okay, it's like a new chance for them. And Ezra is appalled, because when he comes in there to reestablish the religion, to reestablish it and say, we're going to return, we're the ones who have been allowed to return, he comes back and he finds a mess. And people are in violation already of the law of God. And what does he figure is going to happen? He figures it's going to happen all over again. They're going to lose their place again. Because these people can't do the right thing. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, and they can't do the right thing. And so he's horrified, and he spends all this time in prayer, and he tears out his beard, and lots of tearing of things, and sackcloth, and then we skip ahead, and let's go back now to Ezra 9. Go back now to Ezra 9. And Ezra begins to pray, and he has this beautiful prayer. So let's go into that a little bit. Ezra 9, starting in verse 10. And now, O our God, listen to his prayer and understand that he's exactly saying what I'm trying to tell you is it's run through his head. He's scared to death that this is a return to a bad cycle, right? So think of Judges as good cycle, bad cycle. He's got some hope in his heart for a little bit. He comes, he finds a mess. Well, listen to his prayer. And now, O our God, what shall we say after this? For we have forsaken your commandments, which you commanded by your servants, the prophets, saying, the land that you are entering to take possession of it is a land impure with the impurity of the peoples of the lands, with their abomination, who have filled it from end to end with their uncleanness. Therefore, do not give your daughters to their sons, neither take their daughters for your sons, and never seek their peace or prosperity, that you may be strong and eat the good of the land and leave it for an inheritance to your children forever. And after all that has come upon us for our evil deeds and for our great guilt, seeing that you, our God, have punished us less than our iniquities deserve, because they're still alive, that was my insertion, and have given us such a remnant as this, see his remnant, his tiny remnant, shall we break your commandments again and intermarry with the peoples who practice these abominations? Would you not be angry with us until you consumed us so there should be no remnant, no way to escape? Realize that you've only got a few people, and you come back to a city that's big. All right, now it's all in ruins. It's a mess. I mean, read Nehemiah. That's all. He rides around they go out on these night forays around the wall. It's just a broken down heap of rubble. And so Ezra looks at him. He's just a few of us, just a few, a tiny remnant. And that tiny remnant even has sin in their lives and has disobeyed the commandments of God. And Ezra figures it's done. We're through. We'll never make it. And then the most profound thing happens. This incredibly difficult, crazy thing happens. In Ezra, and we're going to go hop down to Ezra 10. Hop down to Ezra 10. Then all the men of Judah and Benjamin assembled at Jerusalem within 3 days. Now prior to this, the part I didn't read, Ezra has said, come to me within 3 days. We've got to talk about this. It was the ninth month on the 20th day of the month, and all the people sat in the open square before the house of God, trembling because of this matter and because of the heavy rain. And Ezra the priest stood up and said to them, you have broken faith and married foreign women, and so increased the guilt of Israel. Now then, make confession to the Lord, the God of your fathers, and do his will. Separate yourselves from the people of the land and from the foreign wives. Then all the assembly answered with a loud voice, it is so. We must do as you have said. But the people are many, and it is a time of heavy rain. We cannot stand in the open, nor is this a task for one day or for two, for we have greatly transgressed in this matter. Let our officials stand for the whole assembly. Let all in our cities who have taken foreign wives come at appointed times, and with them the elders and judges of every city, until the fierce wrath of our God over this matter is turned away from us. Only Jonathan the son of Asahel and Jaziah the son of Tikva opposed this, and Meshulam and Shabbatai the Levite supported them. Then the returned exiles did so. Ezra the priest selected men, heads of fathers' houses, according to their fathers' houses, each of them designated by name. On the first day of the 10th month, they sat down to examine the matter, and by the first day of the first month, they had come to an end of all the men who had married foreign women. And so the story of Ezra ends on an up note, on an upbeat, in that they actually turn and they do the right thing and they get back on the right road. And after 25 minutes of being up here, we finally come to the Pharisees. You probably were wondering when that was going to happen. So the Pharisees' vision of themselves was what? The Pharisees saw themselves as being in the line of Ezra. The Pharisees saw a bright line between them and Ezra. Okay? Ezra's reestablishing the law.
He says out there in the open, look at all of our history. Look at everything that's happened to us. Look at all the times that we have been contradicted, that when we have turned against God, horrible things have happened to us. How will there be any remnant of us left? And so the Pharisees said, yes, Ezra's right. And what we're going to do is we're going to obey God's commandments like no one else has ever obeyed God's commandments before. We're going to do it beyond anyone's wildest imaginings. If there's a commandment of God, we're going to find it, we're going to hunt it down, and we're going to kill it. We're going to obey it. Well, they kind of killed it, right? So that's kind of what they had in their head. They completely were consumed with this idea of if only they could focus and follow the commandments of God, they would get their identity and their nation back. Recall that as they look around themselves, they see themselves still as being underneath this umbrella of Rome. They've got a Roman garrison posted there. They got guards walking through the streets. They don't want that. They'd like to see those guys gone. And so to do that, how do you do it? Well, if you look at the Old Testament, you say to yourself, if I can follow the commandments of God, I can get there. I can get there. And so the Pharisees would have seen themselves in that light. And we know that because even Jesus himself tells them that they saw themselves that way. He kind of quotes them, right? Go to Matthew 23. Now, this is a beatdown passage, right? This is the great woes passage. But what does he say they say, right? So he says here, he kind of quotes them. I like this one part. Matthew 23, 29 through 30. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets.'" And so they are saying that they're looking at the Old Testament and they're saying, we can't be like that. We're not going to be like those people. And so what we'll do is we'll actually build a little monument here to Elijah. Right, and we'll build another one over here to Elisha, and maybe another one over here to Micah or to Zechariah, and we'll decorate it, and we'll have memorials there because we'll say that those guys should never have been put to death. We're going to glorify them, and we are not like our forefathers. We are like Ezra, not like the people before the exile. And so we are going to be following the law, And they are saying that if they had existed and lived then, and they didn't, obviously, but he's saying, they said to Jesus, if we had lived then, we would not have done what those people did. We would not have been like that. We would have been obedient. And now the question becomes, obedient to what? Obedient to what? And here's where they make their stumble. Here's where it all comes apart. Here's where it becomes frightening. If we go to Mark 7, we're going to finish up in Mark 7. "Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat until they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders, and when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, 'Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands?'" Now we might say to ourselves, where did they get this crazy idea of washing all the time? Where did that even come from? Was that just the oral tradition? We might have said, that's their problem. They're practicing the oral tradition. And I would submit to you that I don't think it is. So go over to Exodus 30. If we go over to Exodus 30, 17 through 21, it says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'You shall also make a basin of bronze with its stand of bronze for washing. You shall put it between the tent of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it, with which Aaron and his sons shall wash their feet and their hands when they go into the tent of meeting, or when they come near the altar to minister, to burn a food offering to the Lord. They shall wash with water so that they may not die. They shall wash their hands and their feet so that they may not die. It shall be a statute forever to them, even to him and his offspring throughout their
generations. Now you might answer, well, sure, Justin, but that's to the priesthood. The Pharisees weren't the priesthood. And why did they do all this washing when they were just having a meal? What kind of crazy nonsense is that? They're not going to go into the temple with that kind of stuff. They're just at home. Why did they wash all the time? And I think it's pretty easy for us to put ourselves in their shoes, though, and realize why they might have washed all the time. Because we might say, if it's good enough for the family of the high priest, then shouldn't it be good enough for the rest of Israel? If the high priest does something and he is purified for it, then maybe we should do the same thing. And we might say to ourselves, if the priest washed before doing anything that might have to do with ceremonial cleanliness, then shouldn't all of Israel wash when they were doing anything that had to do with ceremonial cleanliness? And what thing of all Jews' life was the most ceremonial at home? Right, every other ceremonial thing you kind of did was at the temple. Okay, if you went and did your atonement sacrifice, or you went and did your peace sacrifice, or you went and did your wave offering, and you went and did all that stuff, that was temple-based. Okay, but at home, your main ceremonial stuff happens around food. Right, so you don't want to be unclean. And that was all about. It was all about food was clean and food was unclean, and you have all these things. And we can kind of make fun of that, but that was in the Old Testament. And as Dan reads through Leviticus, he's going to come up to a whole lot of food cleanliness laws that say that, hey, if it chews the cud, but it's got a cloven hoof, and it's in this combination, you can imagine almost a set of PowerPoint slides with a graph and who's allowed to eat what, when, how, and why. And so that was very, very ceremonial, and they did this thing at home. And so what we have now is that they're going to go and say, I got to eat this food and I don't want to be unclean. And what's the best way? Well, the priest, when he doesn't want to be unclean, what does he do? And we find over here in Exodus that he washes himself with water. So I should wash myself with water. And I'm going to wash my this with water. I'm going to wash my cups with water. I'm going to wash my dish with water. I'll even wash this dining couch with water where people lay down. And that way everything will be maximally ceremonially clean. And look how obedient we're being, right? And so now, so we get this little side thing where Mark says that. So now go back to Mark 7 again, and let's kind of continue on. Because what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? At that point, you might say, well, I don't know. It's okay if they wash themselves all the time, isn't it? I mean, what's really wrong with that? Jesus says to them, well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written? Well, this sounds pretty harsh for them, right? It says, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. You lead the commandment of God and hold the tradition of men. And he said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. But you say, if a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is karban, that is given to God, then you no longer permit him. Understand Jesus' words there. He doesn't say that you allow him to do whatever he wants. He says you no longer actually even permit him. You don't even let him. You don't even allow him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And I like this little end piece that Jesus says, and many such things you do. Right, so it's like he's so mad, and you do other stuff like that as well. It's just terrible. Now, note carefully in here several statements that Jesus gives in a chain, all right? Mark 7, 7, 7, 8, and 7, 9. Now, let's run them kind of together. He first starts off by quoting, and he quotes from Isaiah. He says, in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Then we hop to 7:8. He says, you leave the commandment of God and hold the tradition of men. And then 7:9, it says, and he said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. And this trio then is followed by this example where he says to them, you've rejected them in this way that you say somebody... Moses said, honor your father and mother. And that was one of the key commandments, right? Remember that the commandments were like a pyramid. And up near the top, of course, at the very top was, you shall love the Lord God with all your heart and soul and with all your mind, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And those were the two greatest commandments. But then underneath those were the 10, right? So violating one of the 10 commandments was, that was a big problem. And he says, number 5 says, honor your father and your mother. And they said, well, yeah, but if it's korban, if you say that thing is korban, then you don't, you not only should you not, but in fact, you are not even permitted to honor your father and your mother with this. And Jesus condemns them for that because they were creating their own law that then nullified the law of God. It nullified the law of God. And that's one of the key elements, the problems that the Pharisees had, that they would create their own new law. They would start with what they thought was the law of God, but as they decided to put their, I've probably talked about this before, but the idea of fencing the law, right? This is very ancient. The Pharisees would do this idea of fencing the law, and the Jews have done it in many centuries since then, where they decide, I need to make sure that the Sabbath is kept holy, but I need to make sure that I never even get close to that. One of the most classic examples is, of course, the name of the Lord in the Bible. We know that we're commanded not to take the name of God in vain. In order to do that, no Jew will ever read the word Yahweh. They will not read that. They will pronounce Adonai when they get to that part of any reading in the Hebrew. If you ever go to a bar mitzvah and they read the sections from there, then they will read Adonai when they hit that area, and they will not say the name of God. So rather than, now that's going too far, right? That's going back too far, right? But they said, well, I'll make sure I never violate this commandment by inventing new commandments that are a barrier around that one. And Jesus might not have had too many problems with that, except that he says, the problem is when you create those new commandments, you decide that the actual commandments don't get followed. You decide, oh, we're not going to do that actual commandment, because it's almost like the commandments are apart from each other, like in some fixed distance. This is not true, but it's almost like this. And then as you fence one, you overcome another. And as you run into it, this one gets pushed off the edge, right? And then because you got this one. You're like, well, I can't go too near that one, so I got to stay away from this. And well, let's just get rid of that one while we're at it. And Jesus says that is nullifying the commandments of God so that you can establish your own law. In closing here, because I got to close, I still have like two more pages. I'm really sorry. I will try to keep it a little closer next time. We humans have as our temptation, I love when Randy said last week that we like to kick the Pharisees, and we do. We love to kick them, right? But we all have some Pharisee in us. There's a little bit of Pharisee in all of us. We have a temptation as humans. We love to create laws. You might say to yourself, no, isn't it the opposite? Don't humans love to not have laws? I think the humans like to not have laws for themselves, but they like to create a lot of laws for other people. All right? Okay, so, you know, and we look at our own society. So you have laws at the federal government level, you got laws at the state level, you got laws at the county level, you got laws at the city level. You know, when you go to work, you got a whole lot of things that we don't call them laws, okay? You don't go to prison if you violate them, but they're policies, they're procedures. They might get you fired if you don't pay attention, okay? That's a pretty good punishment. So they're almost like a mini law. We love to create vast quantities of rules and regulations and systems. We are law creators, we humans are. And in a sense, there's nothing really wrong with that. That's okay. Okay, I'm not saying that that's wrong. Our problem comes in when we create systems of laws that then nullify the real ones. Okay, when we create a system of law that whacks off an actual law. And that's where we run into issues. I want to close this evening by, this morning. I'm going to close this morning, not this evening. I want to close, yeah, it's like I talked so long, it's this evening. We're in the afternoon now. I'm going to close this morning by saying we got to ask ourselves continually and continuously, what is our law? What is it that we're following? Now, we might say, I've used, in the end part here, I meant to apologize about this, but since I've gotten short on time, I have been remiss. I've gone fast and loose with the term law, especially in the last 10 minutes here, right? I'm not saying to you, establish, you know, the old law for yourself. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, as a human, you have things that you believe you're supposed to do. You have laws that you believe you follow. You've got to ask yourself, do those really match what God asked me to do? Am I overcoming his desire with my own desires? Am I taking what I want to do? Am I establishing my own law and then overcoming his law? And the only way that we can do that, the only way that we can get ourselves straight there, is by a very constant and consistent study of the Bible.
It's the only way we can do that, because this becomes like a guide for us, like a meter. It's something that we have to snap a chalk line to and constantly return to over and over again. And it has to speak to us, and it has to chastise us. For years, I did not see the Pharisees as instructive for me. Oh, that might sound weird. I thought the Pharisees were somebody else. That was somebody else's problem. I might like looking at somebody else and saying, you're like a Pharisee, or you're like a Pharisee. But I saw the Pharisees as pretty safe. I think one of the reasons I like to kick them, as Randy said last week, I like to kick them because I felt like I could get away with kicking them. But I too have Pharisaic tendencies. I do. We do. We as people, we seek to create rules and laws and regulations. We seek to pin other people down to them. And then we seek to do away maybe with God's actual laws so that we can replace them with our own, which are ever so much more desirable, and which if other people would follow, would make the world such a better place. And we do that in the church. We do that in our lives. We do that everywhere. If we find ourselves making our own laws, if we study the word and we run into this, if we say to ourselves, I have a law for you to obey in order to be a Christian, right? Here's one of the classic examples. And this is a safe one because none of us are doing this. At least we better not be. But if I say to you, I've got a law and it says that you need to become a Christian. And in order to become a Christian, you need to pray this prayer. Right? Haven't I then at that point taken, and I started with, that was like a tradition of the elders. But what I started with was all the passages about how faith saves me and not works. And those are good passages. Sometimes we have a tendency to kind of gloss them, right? But if I start with all those passages, I say to ourselves, well, all those passages about baptism and stuff, I think I can get rid of those. I think those can go away. Because I got these passages over here. So my law that I'm trying to fence, okay, I'm fencing it, is this law that says faith not works, okay? And so I fence that, and I say, you know, I can't have works, but I also can't, I'm not a universalist, I don't believe everybody's saved, so I got to come up with something. And so I come up with this prayer, and I call it the sinner's prayer. And if you say the sinner's prayer, then you're saved. And what I've done with that, right, is I've fenced that law, I've made a new law, and I've overcome the desires of God, as stated to me in the book. All right, so that's kind of a modern day example. What is your law? Does your law align with God's law? And I have to ask you again, does it really, right? Does it really? Have you examined what it is that you think you, and often most especially what you think others should do, and does it really align with this book? Does it really align with this book? I've gotten so much, I have to tell you, I'm so far over. Never let me do this again. Elena, she's going to have to check that I'm not 6 pages in. I have to tell you, when we study the parables of Christ, I look at that and I'm like, wow, that just is like, it's like grabbing me by the neck and pulling me someplace where I ought to go, someplace different than where I am, right? I'm not there. Okay, but I make rules for other people. I decide this person needs to do this and that person needs to do that. And then Jesus just convicts me with that. He convicts me with the parables. So that's a great place to look at and a great place to study if you're looking for a place to start and a place to learn from. We've got to strive to examine our own beliefs, our own rules, our own little laws, and we have to make absolutely certain that they do not nullify the laws of God. They do not nullify his bigger laws. Remember that Jesus says to the Pharisees in the Woes chapter, he says, you tithe mint and dill and cumin. You tithe down to the tiniest level, but you have neglected the weightier matters of the law, mercy and justice. Okay, so we should also look at ourselves, and when God says the most important thing is love for others, love for him, then we should apply that first and foremost. If you're here this morning and you need anything from us, prayers from the church as a Christian, salvation through a response to the gospel consisting of belief, repentance, confession, and baptism, as the actual Bible says, then would you please come now as we stand to sing the song that's been selected.